This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. At the start of 2021, there were high hopes for COVID-19 vaccines. Nearly 12 months later, millions of Americans are vaccinated, but the vaccines have become increasingly politicized. And in the meantime, Florida weathered the worst impacts of the Delta variant surge over the summer. We're going to take a closer look now at the evolution of the pandemic and how it was reported on in 2021. Abe Abariah is WMFE's health reporter. Abe, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
We're also joined by Veronica Zaragovia. She covers health for WLRN in Miami. Veronica, thanks as well.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Abe, of course, the big story of 2021 remains COVID-19. It seems like there was a lot of optimism at the start of the year around the rollout of vaccines and their impact on the pandemic. What stands out for you as you reflect on how those vaccines were deployed in Florida and kind of how things played out?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking back on this. The amount of effort that was put into the vaccine distribution in the state when it first became available was really pretty staggering to see, just the amount of infrastructure and using, you know, National Guard and these vaccine centers that were, you know, very, very well run in a lot of the places. There obviously were a lot of issues as far as, you know, who was eligible, and there were hiccups as well. But it was a very big logistical effort to get these vaccines out. And then you had actually some criticism of the governor at the time that, you know, he was putting a lot of effort into vaccines as sort of like the one-shot solution, as opposed to other mitigation efforts like masking and social distancing. So it was like, well, the governor's maybe putting all his effort into vaccines. And then that sort of through line shifted as the year went on, and it went to monoclonal antibodies. And then, you know, the vaccines kind of went out of vogue. And so it's really been pretty fascinating to see the evolution of just the public opinion and how the politics has sort of bled into that on just a basic public health issue.
People seem fairly eager to get their hands on a vaccine right at the start of the year. And you wrote about getting a vaccine yourself. Just kind of walk us through what that process is like and how that felt at that point in the pandemic.
Yeah. So I, in the very beginning of it, it was opened up to people, obviously in the older demographic. Mm-hmm. But they allowed in Florida for people, if you had pre-existing medical conditions that a doctor deemed would qualify you. I've had a history of asthma, most of my life. I am a healthy weight now, but at the time that's not always been the case for me. I actually spent most of my life being in the obese category by my BMI. And so my doctor looked at that and some of the other pre-existing conditions and said, you know what, we'll go ahead and get you in. So they announced that. The forms came out on the Department of Health website. I was able to get a consultation with my doctor the same day. And then it was just driving over to the site of Valencia College, where they had this sort of very well-run system of getting people in and out. It was almost like Disney, you know, just line them up and get them through and, you know, sign your paperwork and fill everything out. I mean, emotionally, I definitely... I had anticipated that I was going to feel a lot of emotions by getting it, and even expecting it, I still wanted to cry and cried a little bit, I'm not going to lie. So it was definitely, it kind of puts it in perspective for you, the amount of ways things had changed. And then, okay, we got a vaccine, so now things are starting to look, you know, maybe more normal. Now, in my case, I've got two children at home, one of them who is eligible now for the vaccine, and another one who's not yet eligible by age. So a lot of the things still are haven't changed dramatically. We're not acting like we're fully vaccinated family and everything's good to go, but it's still definitely feeling like things are getting a little bit more back to normal.
Veronica, you were reporting on the vaccine rollout at the start of the year. One aspect which was getting quite a bit of attention then was who was allowed to get it. Just remind us of what was happening with vaccine availability and residency requirements as well.
Right. At first, aside from, say, healthcare workers, when the 65 and older residents were able to get their vaccines, you had to show proof of age. But then by late January, Florida's then Surgeon General Scott Rifkes issued a directive requiring people to be permanent or seasonal residents of the state. And that was because of reports that foreign visitors were flying in just to get their shots. And that is actually something that people suspect is the reason why, for instance, Miami-Dade County continues to have a pretty high vaccination rate. But at the time, it was starting to get a lot of bad press for Florida. So then You had to show something like a mortgage statement or a lease or a driver's license. Even Jackson Health System here in Miami, our large public hospital system, tightened its rules. And what ended up happening is that then people who were here like refugees or persons with temporary protected status who didn't have leases or properties to show were being excluded, as were agriculture workers. So then a lot of advocates for people who are here, not necessarily as citizens, but here with legal status, couldn't get their vaccines. And so it became a very, one scandal came out of another scandal, which in Florida, that's kind of how things go in Florida.
Indeed. And then the story kind of changed a bit, right, as vaccines became more widely available. And we saw some of this happening in Central Florida. But you also reported on how Miami-Dade County leaders were trying to make vaccines more accessible, standing up pop-up clinics, for example.
That's right. As it became more accessible in May, or as the vaccines became more accessible in May, the demand started dropping significantly. The people who had been waiting to get theirs through April got them, and then suddenly there was just no demand. And so the idea became to bring vaccines to where people are rather than expect them to take time out of their day to go get the shot, and also knowing that people either couldn't take the time off or didn't get time off from work for the second shot. So they ended up offering vaccinations on the sand here in Miami Beach or at the airport, at Miami International Airport, outside of bars. That was pretty pretty common all over the country. And sometimes they would do things like, I went to an event supported by the Divine Nine, the sororities and fraternities of historically Black colleges and universities, to try to bring like a more festive atmosphere around getting a vaccine. And so there have been plenty of efforts to, at that point, to get demand back up.
Now, of course, there's always been an element of politics tangled up in COVID-19 vaccines, but that really seems to have only amplified as the pandemic's dragged on. And recently, Veronica, you've been reporting on vaccine mandates and the push and pull between the state and federal officials over those mandates. What's the latest with the state pushback against vaccine mandates?
Right. Well, there have been lawmakers in Florida headed to Tallahassee for a special legislative session in November. The sole focus of that session was to pass bills that did pass and were signed into law by Governor DeSantis that would challenge any kind of vaccination requirement at private workplaces or mask mandates at schools. And so, for instance, a private employer has to allow for religious or medical exemptions to any vaccine requirement. And the state is trying to block in the courts a requirement from the federal government for healthcare workers at facilities that receive Medicaid and Medicare funding. So that could be hospitals and nursing homes and long-term care facilities. They need to have their two shots by January 4th. And actually, a federal judge here decided to let that stand, even though Florida has a new law in effect that tries to block that. But at the moment, it's blocked actually because another federal court in the country has put a hold. So there are all sorts of efforts, including also the state passed a law that would set up its own OSHA, which is Occupational Safety and Health, an agency that would, instead of following the federal guidelines that are requiring for employees to get vaccinated, that the state would come up with its own agency and its own guidelines. But that's going to take a long time, and it's not likely to be approved by the federal agency itself. So there are attempts to try to block vaccine requirements, but I will point out that the federal requirements do allow for regular testing, so they're not mandating vaccines if you're willing to get a regular tested regularly.
Right, and that probably doesn't get maybe a lot of attention necessarily in some aspects. Now, of course, one of the big, I guess, side effects of the pandemic has been its impact on business. Both of you, Abe and Veronica, have been reporting on that impact. Abe, there was a standoff between the cruise ship industry and the state of Florida. The governor threatened to sue cruise ship companies, which demanded proof of vaccination from passengers. Just remind us what was going on there.
Yeah, so that plays very well with the most recent legislative session, the special session. So originally what you had was the big player was Norwegian Cruise Lines because they sail into places that into other countries that have requirements that you must be vaccinated. So Norwegian Cruise Lines was requiring people to be vaccinated to come on board. And so that sort of brought into this standoff. What ended up happening at this point, the state's argument that you cannot require passengers to be vaccinated is on hold. So it's basically up to the cruise line. So at this point, Norwegian, for example, they do require all their passengers to be vaccinated. Some of the other cruise lines might have some exemptions, but, you know, you can come on unvaccinated, but you can't necessarily do all this, you know, shore excursions. You may not be able to get off the ship at different ports. So it's one of the it's another one of those ones that we're still waiting for, you know, the ultimate judicial ruling on it. But at this point, it's still that push and pull between the state and the feds.
If you're just joining us, my guests are WMFE health reporter Abe Abariah and WLRN health reporter Veronica Zaragovia talking about the big stories in healthcare reporting from 2021. COVID, of course, also had a big impact on schools, and some of the key elements of the story involved mask mandates, how and when to keep kids home if they were infected. Abe, where do we stand now with how schools are responding to the pandemic?
Yeah, so the rules on what schools are allowed to do have changed thanks to the most recent special session. So at this point, schools are not allowed to have mask mandates. They are allowed, you know, children are allowed to wear masks. They can't necessarily ban masking. On the other hand, too, if you have been exposed to a known COVID-19 case, but you're asymptomatic, you have no symptoms, school boards are no longer allowed to require you to stay home. So this was one of those issues where, depending on, you know, the parent and the situation at hand, you had people who were maybe having to quarantine and stay home, you know, for weeks at a time, several times during a semester, and that they felt it was very disruptive. But, you know, obviously, on the other hand, there are people who are worried about keeping the spread of the virus down.
Mm-hmm. One of the arguments for reopening schools was that the virus doesn't have as severe an impact on children. Veronica, is there some kind of consensus now on how COVID-19 affects children?
Well, while the side effects haven't been, it's not as likely for a child to develop extreme illness from COVID-19 like somebody, say, 65 and older. Experts do point out to the fact that there have been children who've been intubated or who have died from COVID-19, and that they're also worried about the long-term effects for children who might develop long COVID. And so they do feel like it's something that needs to be taken seriously, and certainly these are the people who are advocating for children to get vaccinated. On the other hand, there have been a lot of concerns about the mental health impact on children who didn't go to school when schools were closed down. And so also that has caused a lot of stress for parents who couldn't afford to leave work during that time or to hire someone to take care of their children. So it's been very difficult, and the arguments on both sides have been, they both carry their weight. Lots of children stopped going to school as well. And so districts like Broward County, but also in Tampa and around the state, they've had their staff members going out, going door to door and looking for children whose parents never or guardians never let the schools know that they had either moved on or were staying home because of the pandemic.
If we think back to summer 2021, Florida became the epicenter for the COVID-19 pandemic. Abe, that had a pretty big impact on hospitals. Just walk us back through what that was like for the hospital system here in Central Florida.
For Advent Health, they were on black status for a fairly long time in the summer. And what that meant was they were delaying anything that was considered a, you know, that could be delayed as far as a procedure. And the reason they were doing that was, you know, the amount of patients that they had with COVID that were requiring, you know, being on a ventilator or ICU care, high-level care like ECMO, the extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is like, you know, basically a external heart and lungs.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot of constraints on that. And so they didn't want to have anything that could possibly be taking up a bed or taking up staff. So we had that happen. There were calls for field hospitals to be brought up. We saw In Brevard County, for example, we did see some field hospitals sort of standing up as well because of the impacts over there. So it absolutely had a major impact. What the actual toll of that is a little bit harder to quantify, but we do know that the all-cause mortality, so if you look at just the number of people who have died, regardless of reasoning, in states that had high levels of ICU occupancy, so you had a lot of people in ICU beds, the all-cause mortality went up after that. So it was some of the studies are showing what people have been saying, which is that, you know, it's not just about COVID. The people who are ending up in the hospital and, you know, causing major shortages of staff and resources, it's affecting other people as well.
Mm-hmm. Veronica, what about the impact on hospital staff? What was your reporting revealing there?
Yeah, there were a lot of hospitals had to and have continued to need to turn to the traveling nurse agencies that charge quite a lot for nurses. And I spoke to a nurse with the 1199 SEIU, the largest healthcare union in the state, and she had explained that on the one issue is that a lot of nurses who are near retirement age have been evaluating whether they should stay on and potentially get infected by the coronavirus or just suffer from the stress of what's going on being short-staffed. Or also they say they've been working, nurses have a team they regularly work with and they know who to rely on during a shift. And when you have new people coming in, it's just very difficult to have that same kind of flow. And so a lot of them were retiring earlier than planned. And then also just, yeah, the cost to the hospital systems to hire temporary nurses. And so the state has argued that these vaccination requirements are making these staffing shortages worse. But the 1199 did end up supporting vaccination requirements so that their nurses and patients are protected. So that continues to be, you know, like a contentious issue.
As it stands now, Florida's cumulative COVID cases are more than 3.7 million, 61,000 deaths. I'm wondering where both of you sort of see the reporting on the story heading in 2022. Abe, where do you see the story going?
I mean, obviously the big question is not just Omicron, but, you know, future variants and what that kind of impact is going to have. I mean, are we going to get to a point where we have a high enough level of vaccinations and, you know, that things kind of go back to normal? Or is this sort of where we're at right now? Or are we going to kind of be in a holding pattern sort of going forward? So I think that's going to be the biggest question for a lot of people is, you know, trying to figure out and keep an eye on what happens next. I think from a policy perspective, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of investments end up in public health because of this. You know, whether we're going to see a more robust public health system in the U.S., for example, for the genetic testing to look for variants. While the U.S. does do more testing than any other country, the per capita rate of testing, you know, samples for new variants is extremely low, just because we have such a huge country. So you might see impacts from there. And the other one that I'm going to continue to keep an eye on, but partly, you know, for personal reasons, but the staff shortages and the nursing shortages, I don't think that's going away. I think that we're in a kind of a spiral with that where the number of people who have left and the staffing shortages and the amount of money that is in going into contract nursing is going to feed that shortage for a longer term. Even if you were to snap your fingers and COVID were to go away, the staffing shortage is not. Hmm. And I've actually seen some of the reports that come out from Moody's, they look at the nonprofit hospital industry, for example. This is some of the first times I'm seeing the people who look at, you know, whether or not nonprofit hospitals can turn a profit and what that industry's outlook is going to be from a financial aspect. Those people who write those reports are saying hospitals need to invest in nursing schools. Mm-hmm. And they're saying it now because of how bad that nursing shortage is and how much that added cost is going to start hitting all these different systems. So I don't see that story going away either.
Veronica, what about you? Where do you see the reporting on COVID-19 heading in 2022?
Well, I'm really looking forward to following Abe's reporting. And to add to that, I would be looking at how it will continue to be such a hot button political issue as we enter a gubernatorial election race and year. And also, there are calls from epidemiologists like Professor Jason Salami at the University of South Florida in Tampa, who's calling on the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to change how they classify a fully vaccinated person. Because at this point, people 65 and older who received their two doses in January, it's just been because these vaccines, while they're extremely effective in preventing death and severe illness, their effectiveness wanes in real world over time. And so he's saying that somebody who's fully vaccinated would should be someone who's received a booster shot. And so that'll be interesting to see how whether that's going to change. And even the discussion around booster shots, because that made me think, well, there's been a little bit of stigma around the booster shot as this privilege for countries like the United States, when so many countries are still struggling to get their population just vaccinated with the first two rounds. So now that it is being seen as essential to preventing severe illness at this point in the pandemic, as it continues to draw on, I'll be looking at that. And also mental health stories. People are still really struggling during this pandemic. And hopefully, you know what, so, happy stories too, because I know that a lot of this has been negative, but I'm always looking for some good stories. So maybe we'll find nurses doing better. We'll see. So I'll try to find a silver lining where I can find one.
And of course, in amongst all of this reporting on COVID-19, Veronica, it was a busy year for you too, because you one of the biggest stories for you this year was the Surfside tragedy. I just wonder, how is that community coping now, months after that building collapse?
The community continues to struggle. It's less visual now because the memorial has been taken down and that building has been completely, all of the rubble has been completely removed. I pass by there all the time and it's just a big vacant lot. And so the focus is now on the court hearings that take place. They used to take place every week. Now they're every 2 weeks, and there'll be an auction in it's expected late February among developers who are bidding for that property. Family members try to organize press conferences to raise awareness around their desires for there to be a memorial built on that property. But it seems like that's been really quieted, as the judge is just saying, you know, you're going to devalue the land if you keep doing this, and developers are going to put whatever they deem fit. And he's been trying to just get the most money possible to compensate people. So there's tension also on how the money's going to be divided. So unfortunately, it's become a bit of there's just a lot of tension among people who lost their apartments and then the people who lost loved ones, and they haven't been seeing eye to eye how they're going to split the money. So I'm still following it, but it's less in Surfside and more in the court in Miami.
And we'll be following your reporting on that as well. Well, Veronica Zaragovia covers health for WLRN in Miami. Veronica, thank you so much for your reporting and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Also joined by Abe Abariah, WMFE's health reporter. Abe, thanks as well.
Absolutely.